Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The World Transformed on the Blog Talk Radio Network. The World Transformed is an audio production of Speculist Media, and you can find us online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your world, in your life, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that end somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, you know, I'm super fantastic, of course, but I have been fighting some kind of virus for like 2 weeks, and it's...
Your voice has a different quality. It's a little more, I don't know, scratchy or whatever. So, yeah.
Well,
you going to get through the show?
Well, I've got the mute button standing by. So if I go silent, it's probably not our technical glitch of the evening. It's actually me coughing. And yes, I'm very conscious of my speaking because I'm trying not to get too worked up, go too fast, need moisture so bad that I kick off a coughing fit because I've had a pretty bad cough. But it's one of these things where you say, well, we've made tremendous progress over the last few years, over the last few centuries, decades, whatever. But this is one of those things where, you go to the doctor and there's still not all that much help. He goes, yeah, it's a virus. And I'm like, well, I've been coughing for 2 weeks. He goes, yeah, I see a lot of people have been coughing for 2 weeks. I'm like, well, thanks a lot, doctor. he gave me a prescription to some cough syrup that he said would help me sleep, which I've taken now before the show so I wouldn't cough so badly. So that could lead to some interesting things too. And then he gave me a prescription for an antibiotic, and he said it might be whooping cough, but that's a $300 test. You don't want to take a $300 test, Ian. I'm like, I really don't want to take a $300 test if you don't think it is. And he goes, it's probably not, but if you don't get any better, get this antibiotic because it's going to be a lot cheaper than taking the $300 test. And if you do have whooping cough, it'll take.
That's
it
the
out.
Right thing for the whooping cough if you happen to have it. Huh?
Yeah, I'm just as I'm driving home, I'm thinking, okay, well, this is better than bury a toad at midnight under the light of a full moon, but it's still not quite as precise as we would like the whole process to be, I feel like.
So your inner Dr. McCoy was going, barbaric.
Exactly, yes. Stone knives and bear skins, yeah. Yes, my inner Dr. McCoy did not approve of the process, I have to say. I want to go in, he runs a tricorder over me, and, he shoots some nanomedicine into me, and
just before the show, I was giving you heck about the fact that you have not yet seen Iron Man 3, so we can't talk about it. I know.
I
have so much I want
to
discuss with you on that.
It's been out for 6 days,
and
I still haven't seen it.
You're behind the curve, man. And we're talking about Dr. McCoy. You have any plans to see Star Trek this weekend? Now keep in mind, your geek cred is on the line. What is your answer?
The plan was to go see it with my wife, and I haven't lined up a sitter, so I'm not sure I'm going to be able to go see Star Trek this weekend. So, I'm losing some geek points here. I'll see what we can work out. And I missed Iron Man last week. We actually went to a musical last week. It's like live, world premiere of Sense and Sensibility, the musical here in Denver. And it was
Did it have cyborgs? Did it have flying armor? You know,
it really didn't have any of that stuff. Jane Austen was awesome, but none of that stuff occurred to her. You know, it's funny because there have been all these postmodern remakes of Jane Austen novels. There was Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters. Somebody could do something like that, I'm sure. You know,
Just
cyborgs or something like that.
Hey, you know what they need to do? Is they need to take Robert Downey Jr.'s Sherlock Holmes and make a steampunk Iron Man.
That'd be pretty cool. That would be pretty cool.
I would go see that. I would
have
Holmes
actually become like a steampunk Iron Man.
Yeah, exactly.
Just throwing that out there.
So anybody with some money to make a movie, quite a bit of money, I would think. There's you an idea, and it's for free. I throw that out there in the hopes it gets made.
Yeah, that would be cool. Okay, so let me ask you, but you know, before we get into the show, because we've got a lot of really important stuff to talk about. But how'd you like Iron Man, and more importantly, how'd the boys like it?
We all thought Iron Man 3 was great, but that's no real surprise. Iron Man, you know, we laugh about how it's just a movie and everything, but Tony Stark is really kind of a is an actual hero to my boys and I. I mean, he's the guy that just, you know, he took this and made it in a cave, you know, with a box of scraps.
Right. Yeah.
You know, he's that guy. He can I wanted to talk about the movie again. I can't do it. But anyway, that part of the character is just it's an important part of the character to us, and it's explored a little. So, there's a subplot involving a kid, and that appealed to my sons. They liked that, and I think you would have gathered that much from the previews. So I'm not giving too much away with that. So.
Well, very cool.
Yeah,
right. Well,
it's a lot of fun.
I'm going to try to work it in.
Yeah,
I'll try to work it in between now and next Wednesday.
I've got
a short week between now and next week's show. But
we are doing this show at a slightly different night. We do appreciate the folks that are listening in live. I see some of the regulars in the chat room, and appreciate you guys joining us on a weird night.
Yeah, thanks for your flexibility, everybody. Again, it's my health is the reason. I couldn't quite get organized to get a show together. And people have been asking, I should mention, we are short a producer once again. Erica has moved on to some other things that she has to be doing in the evening. She's working on getting some education, actually, right now. She's studying for her real estate license. So we are Sun's producer, and I'm back into that role. I love doing it, but just couldn't quite get it together to have a show last night. So, yeah, appreciate everybody being with us tonight. And we've got a really cool topic, one that I wanted very much to talk about last night, so I'm glad we're able to talk about it tonight. This is it's a post I wrote over at worldtransform.com, and also I picked it up on Transparency Revolution, and Glenn Reynolds linked it, which was nice of him, and it kicked off a pretty good-sized discussion over on Transparency Revolution. But the topic is catastrophic success, and I take that phrase from K. Eric Drexler from his new book, Radical Abundance, which, Stephen, I know you've got the book too. I got it the first day it was available. I had actually asked for an advance copy because I'm writing a review, but I apparently didn't ask the right person. I never did get an advance copy, so I bought it the first day I could, and I've been reading it ever since, and I'm quite drawn into the book, I have to say. Drexler is he's a good writer. He has fascinating ideas. And he is he doesn't hold back on the detail. He gets into it, or he draws out his argument as he needs to. And
he does not assume that his readers will not understand. He throws it on out there and assuming you will understand. And
that's right. I mean, this book is written for a popular detail. Written for a popular audience the way Engines of Creation was. It's not written for a technical audience the way Nanosystems was. But even so, it's I would say a select subsection of the popular audience who are going to track with the arguments in this book.
I would say it would correlate well with our audience on the show. So
absolutely,
if you're having interest in this show, you're probably going to enjoy this book too.
And we've agreed we're going to do a show on radical abundance in a couple of weeks, and we'll see if we can line up a guest. I don't know that we'll be able to get Mr. Drexler. He's a person I've been in contact with. I've met him and have been trying to get him on First Fast Forward Radio and the World Transformed for some time. If we can get him on, awesome. But if not, you and I will talk about it, and we'll see if we can line up. I'm sure somebody from our regular bullpen of guests might want to come on and talk about that too. We'll see if we can line somebody up. But tonight we're not talking about the subject of radical abundance per se. That book is about atomically precise manufacturing and the tremendous impact that Drexler predicts that it's going to have on the world. Something that we've talked about in the past. Anyhow, we're gonna talk a little bit more about the impact, and we're gonna talk about this phrase that Drexler uses early on in the book to talk about how big of a shift that might be. And the phrase he uses is catastrophic success. Two words that I think go great together. It's kind of like it's one of those phrases that gets your attention, kind of like in the future everything will be a coffee shop. You know, it's just one of those one of those ideas that you immediately resonate with it. To me, it takes the idea of creative destruction up a notch, and to me, it seems to fill a gap we have, which is because we talk all the time about creative destruction, and I blog quite a bit over at Transparency Revolution about what I see happening potentially to the world of employment, and a lot of that apparently driven by technological changes. I think that it's anybody's guess, actually, what the employment picture is going to look like 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. I mean, it's really hard to say. There's hope that the economy is really going to pick up. I mean, we hope that will happen in any case, and that when that does, the employment picture will improve significantly. People will be going back to work. Jobs will be recreated, all the things that, that typically happen. One of the problems with that hope is that we've actually been out of recession for some time now, and the lag in the reintroduction of jobs is completely unprecedented.
Yeah, we have a growing economy, and our unemployment rate's still remarkably high. That's a little bit disconcerting, isn't it?
Well, it absolutely is. And not only is the unemployment rate high, actually the unemployment rate went down just a little bit in the last jobs report. I track these every time they come out. But more disturbing even than that is how really rapidly the size of the workforce is diminishing. So when you say today that whatever it is, 7.6% of people are out of work, you're actually talking about 7.6% of a much smaller number than you used to, because a lot of people are just not trying anymore. They've either gone on Social Security disability.
And a lot of people people do not understand that that's how that works. If you are not actively seeking employment, they don't count you anymore. So.
Right.
You know, you're not even an unemployment statistic if you're not seeking a job after a certain period of time.
Yeah, you're no longer part of the workforce, and the workforce is just smaller than it was. So to me, we get into these discussions sometimes over at Transparency Revolution about this, and there is a long established precedent for creative destruction, for the idea of and I see it as it's a flavor of technological disruption. And what creative destruction is when a new technology comes in, it tears out a whole set of infrastructure or a whole set of markets, even an entire industry or how an industry is organized. But it replaces it with something bigger, something better, something that gives you a lot more employment. That's creative destruction, and we always see the creative side, and we say, well, it's just, you know, it's unfortunate for those whose livelihoods are lost, but many more livelihoods are created, and you know, the cliche is the automobile comes along, the buggy whip makers get put out of business, but a lot of them get nice assembly line jobs in Detroit, and no one's complaining about anything, right? Because they're making more money than they did before, and there's a lot more jobs than there were before. That's creative destruction. It's a form of technological disruption. And just to back up, maybe we should talk a little bit about what we mean by disruptive technologies. Actually, that might be a little bit harder to define. What's the difference, Stephen, between a new technology and a disruptive technology, in your view?
Disruptive technology completely destroys the need for the technology that went before it. What's a good example? What is the need really for a spinning wheel once you have the steam powered looms of the 19th century? Once those were in place, I suppose a sewing machine was still needed for
right.
for an individual to sew, but you didn't make your own cloth anymore. It's a disruptive technology in the sense that those who are building the technology that went before, they all lose their jobs. There's no need for that particular technology anymore because we got something brand new now. Gaslight people, when the light bulb came along, those folks, that was phased out pretty fast in favor of the electric light because it was cheaper and better.
And actually, I think all the examples you're giving are both of disruption and of what I would call creative destruction because, something is actually being destroyed in the process. I think some technologies come along and they're disruptive, but they don't necessarily take something else out. They add something new, like when the compact disc came along.
Right.
Vinyl still existed and cassette still existed. Now, it took a big market share away from it. It was very disruptive to the market, but it didn't take anything out of the picture completely. Whereas MP3s, eventually it did, right? I guess ultimately people were pretty much on CDs and even cassettes got left behind. So it took longer. But MP3s, they came along, and that was creative destruction, right? Because the CD market just went. I mean, I guess some people still buy audio CDs, right? I suppose.
Why would you? At this point, they don't have improved audio quality. The reason we still have vinyl is because some people prefer that audio quality to digital. The audiophiles say they hear a difference. Perhaps my hearing is not good enough to tell the difference because I really don't hear the difference between, or maybe it's my vinyl equipment. I don't know, but I don't hear a difference. But some people say they do, and if they do, they do. There's no difference between the audio quality, literally no difference at all between the audio quality of a CD and and an MP3. It's all digital. It's still digital.
Right.
It's just that you don't have to keep up with with physical media that's going to get scratched and lost. So,
and you can just carry a lot more music with you.
That's right.
With your iPod or your iPhone than with.
And your music store is always with you too.
Exactly.
You don't have to go downtown or something. You can, if you're interested in an album, you buy it right there on your phone. So it's just better all around. That's a great example. That's disruption.
Right. Here's a good. Jeb's got a great example in the chat room. Talks about how glass gave intellectuals 20 to 30 more years of creative life because it provided eyeglasses. Right. There's a nice example of a totally disruptive technology that didn't necessarily replace anything. What did it replace? Not being able to see, I guess.
It replaced blindness. I don't think that there was a real market for that. That's a great example.
A good example of a disruptive technology. I remember reading a book years ago called Unleashing the Killer App, and one of the great all-time great killer apps that was listed in there was the stirrup on the horse. Which actually enabled warfare in a completely new way, and the armies that started using it first became really powerful.
Dominant.
You could fire
a bow and arrow at full gallop.
Exactly. Right. Suddenly you had this way of.
Of course, that sounds like a good way for me to end up on my butt. Apparently, those guys that lived in the saddle.
People good at shooting arrows and riding horses.
And riding,
like
they were
that.
Able to do it.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's disruption. Disruption is,
right.
I guess the only other kind of technology would be technology that is just completely invisible to us. Some improvements come along we don't even notice.
Right.
So they're not disruptive. But probably to some extent, any technology is disruptive. And most disruptive technologies do leave some kind of a wake, some kind of destruction in their wake. And it's really interesting when you see something like the iPod, which came along, and like I said, was very unforgiving to the music business in a lot of ways. I mean, it's great for us, great for the consumers, and in a lot of ways great for the artists because of the new distribution methodologies it made possible. We're really hard on people who made money selling selling CDs. And then the iPhone comes along, and Apple's, you know, creatively destroying its own market for its own product with the iPhone. Suddenly they've got buy this phone and we throw an iPod in for free.
I think I think you told me about a month or two ago that that you still own an iPod, an actual iPod. Is that still true?
Do you still use it? I do. I own. Okay. Well, I didn't say use. I still own it. I haven't used it
you
lately.
You still own it. Well, I guess the better question is, do you use it?
I haven't used it lately. It's true.
Okay.
There were instances that I used it that don't seem to come up. It seems like it was better for mowing the lawn. So summer's coming. I might get it back out again.
Okay.
But I mean,
yeah,
Apple still makes
I can
them.
See
still,
why you would want to use
iPods.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. You can buy iPods. You know, these the little shuffles and things like that are relatively cheap, and there are reasons that you might want to do that instead of have your phone. I mean, those phones are pretty expensive. If you're in a situation where you're afraid of losing or messing up your phone, that you might pull out an iPod. But otherwise, I quite frankly have not used an iPod since I bought my first iPhone. So, you know, it kind of my iPod disappeared into my phone, and I haven't missed it. So,
well, there you go.
My camera did too. So,
cameras are a good point. Have you seen? There's a beautiful new commercial out from Apple showing people taking pictures with their iPhones.
Right.
And
it is a great commercial. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a wonderful commercial, and it ends with them pointing out that the iPhone is the world's best-selling camera. In fact, not just best-selling
more
camera,
people
the
are
more
taking pictures. Yeah.
Yeah, more pictures are taken on iPhones than with any other camera. I think that's what they say.
Yeah.
And that is pretty astounding. When you think about that, you think, okay, there's some
disruption. It's not even meant to be a camera. We think of it as the name is phone. You know, it's
right.
An iPhone, not an iCamera. But
yeah,
yet it's the biggest camera in the world as far as the number of pictures taken. That's pretty astounding. Yeah.
And
so.
you've got to think that a lot of cameras have not been sold as a result of right? I mean, you know,
right.
there's some creative destruction going on there. There's a definite disruption into the camera market. Digital cameras were a huge disruption into the film market. That was some creative destruction there. And then something like the iPhone comes along, which just it just lays waste potentially to all kinds of in some ways. The iPhone represents what approaches catastrophic success. Although I'm not gonna brand it that because I think that that word catastrophic really hits on the fear of the massive kind of social change we're talking about when we look at some of these things like employment, basic how is the economy going to be organized kind of questions
of course
we run into.
Of course, the book on the subject was written by Martin Ford. He wrote The Lights in the Tunnel, and he was a guest on Fast Forward Radio a while back. But, I mean, the whole idea is this. I mean, to the extent that we automate and we get better and better at automating and more jobs can be automated out of existence, at what point are we all sitting here with, abundance everywhere but with no jobs? And what does that world look like? You know, I mean, success, yes. Catastrophic, you bet. You know what I mean? Our whole world is built on a model that, we prepare kids to be productive in a workplace. We base our self worth to a great extent, maybe to an unhealthy extent, on what it is that we do for a living. And we do that for a period of 35, 40 years, give or take.
Right.
And then there's a period of retirement and followed by death. That's the basic life plan for
right.
that we've had for however long, and that's about to go away, you know. So anyway, according to Martin Ford and many others. So I don't know. I guess that's the whole point of this show. Huh? Catastrophic success.
That right there is catastrophic success, and we're going to come back to that in a few minutes. So I thought we'd build up to it by talking about a few examples from some of the lesser forms of disruption as we kind of work our way up to it. And I was thinking,
okay,
you know, what are some disruptive technologies that we have right now that are showing up now, or that promise to be here in the near future? Not necessarily that are at the stage of leading to absolute catastrophic success, but that are disruptive. And one of them that comes to mind is the 3D printer.
Right.
As they stand now, they're disruptive. They're interesting, and you have things like this. We've got the. I'll go ahead and put the link in the chat room. This great story over on BetaBeat. Somebody made an iPhone shoe using a 3D printer. And I don't know if you saw this, but.
Yeah.
You know, they basically printed out a shoe that has an iPhone case in it.
Yeah, and it's kind of an interesting looking thing there. A lot of people may ask, why in the world would anyone want that? That's the wrong question, isn't it? You know, once you have a 3D printer, the question is not, how big is the market for whatever weird thing I want to make. Because your market can be just one. If I want it, that's all that matters once you have a 3D printer. You know, you're not thinking for large groups or economies of scale, because one is just as economical as anything else once you have a 3D printer. It changes the whole manufacturing world.
You know, it's really interesting that around the time smartphones or the predecessors of smartphones, around the time that phones started taking pictures – there was an interesting thing going on with kitchen appliances, and I think this went away. I don't know that they're still doing this, where they were building TV screens into, like, refrigerators.
Right.
Did you ever
see
that?
They tried that. That was sort of a that was a failed project, but it was an interesting project, though.
Those two things happened at about the same time, and I was completely baffled by both of them, okay? I looked at both of them, and I said, you know, some things are meant to go together, and some things are not meant to go together. And this is, why I am a futurist, a person who's interested in the future, not a person who claims to be able to predict it very well, because I looked at that and said, I don't think this will catch on. Nobody's going to have nobody needs to have a TV built into their refrigerator. You want a TV, you can place it anywhere you want, you know, and your refrigerator has to be in a certain place. This makes no sense to me. This isn't going to work. And why in the world would you need a camera in your phone? You know, I'm lumping these two things together. Nobody needs a camera in their phone. That's crazy. So,
I disagreed with you early on that. You might remember my Batman utility belt post on the Speculist, I mean, years ago. That's one of my first posts, probably 5 or 6 years ago, where I was making fun of the whole notion that, you know, we need to have a camera and a separate, you know, and I listed off all these things, including an iPod and a pager and all these things, and I said what we need is one gadget for all those things. And so I took issue with you on that early. I got a 2 mile
well, in
point
fact,
on that
no,
deal.
I had taken that. It was a couple years before that I had taken that stand.
Okay.
So you actually brought me around. By the time you started talking Batman utility belt, I was like, yeah, you know, I can pretty much see it. But all that goes to say is that. In the past, if you wanted to make some weird combination of things, you had to be General Electric or Apple, right? You know, you had to, or whoever did the first picture phone, Samsung, whoever did it. You had to be a huge conglomerate. Now, anybody who wants to, who has an idea, how about a shoe and a smartphone? Yeah, I think that those two go well together. You can do it. You know, any weird idea that anybody has, we're approaching the age where they can realize that vision of that particular product. And it doesn't necessarily have to be an odd combination of things, like a shoe phone, although I think that is a wonderful example of an odd combination of things. It can just be something completely new. Somebody has an idea for something that doesn't currently exist, that they would like to see exist, or an improved version of something that does exist, and now they have the ability to model that on their computer and print that sucker out, whatever that item is. And that, to me, that is a fantastic example of disruption. How much creative destruction that will lead to? I don't know. I think it's a while before the toothbrush makers are in trouble because everyone's printing out their own toothbrushes or anything like that. But the idea that people can invent completely new things using 3D printers, I think, is an intriguing one, and I think that's going to lead us into some pretty interesting directions. Then another one that comes to mind for me, other than the 3D printer, is CNN had the story, I think it was just today, is this finally the flying car? Did you see that?
I did not. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well.
Missed that one.
Yeah, it comes from Woburn, Massachusetts. They've begun feasibility studies on a car capable of vertical takeoffs and landings, which I think is an important missing piece from most of the flying car designs we've seen up to now. So it kind of looks like a little jet aircraft. I mean, it kind of looks like a little Harrier, but it also looks like a car. I'll go ahead and put the link in the chat room. Now, to me, this is a fantastic example of something that has been talked about forever. It has always been viewed as kind of a hallmark of the future, and were it to come along, would be a truly disruptive technology. I don't know how much creative destruction it would actually leave in its wake. I think there would still be cars driving on the road, and I think there'd still be aircraft, and commercial air travel would still exist. It seems to me it'd be a new thing that people would
right.
be able to do, which is to be able to fly around in their cars rather than drive around on the ground. But I think it would be a massively disruptive technology just because, wow.
Well right now we kind of have a hole in our infrastructure regarding short flights, because I mean you still have in order to check in at an airport, you're going to take as much time checking in for a very short flight as you would for a flight across the country, right?
Yes.
And it's very much worth it for a flight across the country, but if it's a flight from Denver to Colorado Springs, Phil, you're going to just jump in the car. By the time you get checked out at the airport, and then get on the aircraft and fly there and then arrange transportation at the destination, it'd be much better to just have driven for short flights. Whereas, if you have your own car that can fly too, then you will fly on those shorter trips. And so, yeah, you're just adding something new to the mix if people actually have something like that. So that's pretty cool.
I think it's a good example of it'll disrupt. Doesn't necessarily destroy a lot. It will give us more choice. The way glass gave us more choices, or the stirrup gave us more choices. Now, so let's take it. I'm sorry, Stephen. Did you have some other examples you wanted to lay out there?
No, that those are good. I like that. We'll go with those.
Those are a couple. Now let's think about some that do lead to creative destruction. We talked about how the automobile came along and it destroyed the horse-drawn world, basically, right?
Right.
But it was very much creative destruction because of the economic opportunities that it presented. Computers generally have been tremendous harbingers of disruption and disruption of the creative destruction variety. You look at big sections of the publishing and the music business, and
I would throw the printer in as part of that picture.
Absolutely, yes.
Because that printer just put large segments of the printing industry out of business. Now we still have printing industry, but it's quite a bit altered from what it was in the 70s or 80s. It's just it's not what it was. Because we do so much at our own desks now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the next generation of 3D printers that we're going to see is going to be very disruptive, and it's going to destroy more. And generally, this whole process, Stephen, that we've talked about over the last, 2 years now, year and a half now, of coffee shopification. In the future, everything will be a coffee shop. That is all about computer technology, information technology, wiping out infrastructure. I mean, that's really what it is.
I think there is a key part of 3D printing that that I don't know that we've actually mentioned on the show before, but that is going, you know, I'll just say it's a milestone. Once we hit it, we know we're in for a wild ride after that, and that is this. Once we're able to print a circuit board within a piece of plastic as one print run, watch out. We'll be creating our own electronics and doing things that, you know, formerly required whole industries to do. We'll be doing it ourselves on our own whims, you know. You got an idea for a particular electronic product, you just do it. And that's going to be that to me, once they're able to do that, that's going to be a big, big deal.
That's going to be huge.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And now, does that take things out of the market, do you think? Is that creative destruction, or is that more of just incremental good stuff?
It's creative destruction because there are going to be things that are no longer, there's not going to be a need to make in mass quantities anymore. People will, you know, and there's going to be a whole different way of looking at cost structures because, you know, in order for something to be worthwhile to make in massive runs, and that's, let me back up and say, that is the reason probably printing out toothbrushes would be the last thing that that will, you know, the toothbrush industry is safe for a while, okay? The
unless
reason
people are going to do really wacky toothbrushes, I agree.
Unless you've got an idea for a completely outlandish toothbrush that brushes both sides of your teeth and flosses at the same time and plays a tune while you do it. If you got some great idea for that, then that's great. But the normal toothbrush is safe for a while because it can be made so cheaply in huge runs, and they are pretty good. You know, I mean, it's hard to make an improvement upon the toothbrush. It's just it's a good product that's been around. It's and been tested for hundreds of years now, and I would say at least since the 19th century.
Ancient Egypt, right? They've been around a long time. Yeah.
I guess so. Yeah, it's been around a while. So even in the ancient world, huh? So you're not going to see a huge improvement on it with 3D printing and things like that. And since they can be made so cheaply, why print out something that's going to cost you in plastic and everything else and in time, $5 when you can buy one for 30 cents down at the store. So, yeah, I think that when you have the circuit boards that are that you can print in the product, then it's going to be that's going to be a big deal then.
Absolutely. I wanted to mention one other example of disruption that I think was absolutely the opposite of creative destruction. That was this piece you linked over on Facebook the other day about this guy who single-handedly planted a 1,360-acre forest.
Yeah, he didn't take anybody's job, did he?
No.
This marvelous, wonderful thing. How many acres was it? It was like 1,300, you said?
1,300 acres, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. He took, just looks like, you know, in India, it looked like a prairie. It's just open nothingness and began planting. And he basically has a jungle now. And what makes it so interesting is from our standpoint, when we plant forests over here, we plant all pine trees and things like that. It was a monoculture type situation. Not him. He went out and planted all kinds of trees, and it makes it look like it's a natural forest. And because he's got such a great, ecology going there, it's beautiful.
When I look at the picture on that, I wonder how much did he plant and how much kind of showed up. You know what I mean? Because
I think he was blessed with a lot of it showing up once he got it to a certain point. I imagine.
Yeah. It's like he created the environment.
Nature came along and helped.
Yeah, the habitat for it, and then these other plants start showing up. Anyway, to me, it's remarkable, and what it speaks to is one of our other threads that we talk about all the time, which is the capability of people, that human beings are capable of doing more and more. Here's a guy actually not particularly empowered by technology that I know of, who just demonstrates how much a human being can actually do. So that's why there's an upside coming from all the potential downside we're going to talk about here in a second on the subject of catastrophic success, which is that people have a lot of good they can still do. In fact, because of technology, people have more good than they could have done before. People can do interesting things. People can do creative things. People can do valuable things. They're just not necessarily part of the economy as it has existed up to this point. And that's where the big changes that we're talking about when we talk about catastrophic success occur. And I've identified, I think, four big drivers of this.
Okay.
And one of them is the automation of labor generally. Okay.
Right.
By any means, seems to lead in the direction of catastrophic success. We've already talked about.
You're talking both AI and robot, and the two put together. You got, we've had robots that have been automating the, for example, the automobile industry since what, the 60s.
Yeah.
They've been taking more and more jobs can now be automated, and a lot of it's the growth of the computer industry and Moore's Law.
Production's going up. I mean, to get back to what we were talking about before, production,
yeah.
The economy's growing. Production's going up. The
right.
number of people participating is going down. And something I wrote about on Transparency Revolution a few weeks ago is really shocking, this graph showing the people exiting not just the job market but the manufacturing sector. It's amazing. When you look at that line going down and the line showing production going up, you go, wow, there it is.
It's the old joke that ultimately we'll have the manufacturing place will be man by a man and a dog. Is that
the factory of the future? Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, the factory of the future, man and a dog run it. It's the and the dog is there to bite the man if he tries to touch anything. Right.
Right. Yeah. The man's job is to feed the dog. The dog's job is to make sure the man doesn't touch anything.
That's right.
So even the man and the dog are pretty redundant, actually.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's
nothing really needed there. It's just pure automation. So yeah, automation of labor generally.
Yeah.
The next one is coffee shopification, which is this application of. Just the de-infrastructurization of institutions, I think. Is that a fair way to describe coffee shopification? It's when educational institutions or businesses or
everything
anything
is a coffee
that,
shop.
Yeah,
yeah, because
anything
you no longer need a place to congregate necessarily. You don't need standard offices anymore because. All the tools of your trade can be in a laptop now. You don't, and you don't need to be in the same room with someone to get to collaborate. You know, you got your smartphone sitting right next to your laptop. I mean, when so much of our work now is based on those two tools, okay? You don't have to be in a particular office anymore. The local coffee shop is good enough.
Right.
So I think that's coffee shopification. That's when the whole world kind of goes that direction. It includes education and everything else. You know, you don't even need a standard classroom anymore. You can get your education using your laptop and your smartphone right there in your coffee shop or in your house or anywhere else. I've had people say, "Well, I don't even like coffee." It's not about coffee. It's anywhere in the world you want to be. I happen to like being in a coffee shop. Any place you want to be, you no longer have to be in any physical place to do any particular mental work. It can be done anywhere. So.
Well, I was talking about that resort I was at in Mexico that had the Wi-Fi everywhere. Right, you can be on the beach. And doing that work, so maybe it's the beachification of.
If that's what you like, if that's where you like to be, absolutely.
Think about that. In the future, everything will be a coffee shop or beach. Something there.
You know, ski slope or whatever it is you like.
Exactly, whatever you like. In my case, it's my basement. But some people think bigger. Okay, so those are two big trends, and then I think there's two big enabling. Technologies that become categories in their own right. One of those is artificial intelligence, and the other one is I'm listing it as APM. We've thought of it as nanotechnology in the past, but I'm going to go ahead and use Drexler's term that he's using, the atomically precise manufacturing. Now, here's what's interesting. Any one of these trends in and of itself, or any one of these technologies or trends in and of itself, has the potential to reshape the economy beyond recognition.
But right.
We're in an era where two of them are going on rapidly, and the other two are in their early stages. Artificial intelligence is with us, and it's taking on a bigger and bigger role. We don't have artificial general intelligence yet, but we might not even need to get to that point for artificial intelligence to become a hugely destructive technology in terms of
right.
employment and infrastructure and that kind of stuff. And
well, yeah, and can I give you a good example? I mean,
please.
there's a huge reason that you got places like Google and companies like Apple and things like that. They, you know, Apple's the biggest company in the world again, I believe. It's it goes back and forth. I think Microsoft took the lead at one point here recently. But at any rate, these are and particularly with Google, for example, they, you know, these companies are worth billions and billions of dollars, and you know, and it's amazing how few people that work there. You know,
right.
It's just remarkable that you can get so much production out of so few people, and a big part of that is AI. You know, you don't need artificial general intelligence to see a complete reworking of the workforce, because now because of the leverage that just regular AI gives them. You're able to see, you know, multi-billion-dollar companies run by a relative handful of people, and so yeah, you don't even need to get the AGI, but watch out when we do.
Yeah, well, when you look at it, I think it's fair to say that all four of these trends mm-hmm. and technologies impact each other, and they all have something to do with each other. But what we're going to see is that artificial intelligence becomes the big accelerator of automation.
Yeah,
we go from this place where before we automated physical tasks, but everybody was theoretically moving up the employment food chain, and then we were all doing intellectual tasks. And now we're going to automate the intellectual tasks, and watch out. You know, what's left for what's left for human beings to do? There's less and less for us to do. While that occurs, an interesting thing that happens in the economy is that this productive capability and the wealth that goes with it is concentrated into a smaller and smaller number of entities, businesses, but also ultimately individuals. And all of the wealth that is accumulated in the productive economy ends up falling into a smaller set of buckets, but they're big buckets because you've got just a few people operating extremely complex machines that are making tons and tons and tons of money. And as the creative destruction occurs of all the rest of the infrastructure dependent businesses, it's a very interesting dilemma where suddenly you have this massive wealth inequality, which I typically don't worry about, and I don't want to go off on a tangent about wealth inequality, because I think I never care about how high the top is. The only thing, as far as inequality is concerned, the only thing I'm ever concerned about is how low the bottom gets. I'm always like, well, just keep lifting the bottom up. That's the thing that actually matters. But what disappears in the process is the opportunity of the bottom, which is hugely widespread now. It's all of us, to be part of the economy. And suddenly you say, well, now what do we do? Well, there's this other big driver going on, and that's APM. Nanotechnology is going to make it possible to it accelerates coffee shopification. It accelerates the de-infrastructurization, which is why coffee shopification is a much better word, of everything, right? We talked about institutions before, but now we're talking about industries, and we're talking about heavy industries having their infrastructure taken away from them or becoming unreliant on them. And Drexler in the book talks about cars being manufactured in spaces the size of a garage, right? So you can, you can basically make a car anywhere, and anybody who wants to will be able to get their hands on the materials that they need to make a car. And if you take that principle and you apply it across the board to anything a person might need, including shelter and transportation and clothing and potentially even food. The whole supply chain of agriculture and manufacturing is all wiped out, and all the people who work in those sectors are out of a job. But
we're
all better off as long as we all have access to that new technology.
Here's another good example of that. Imagine, let's just consider auto drive cars. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Let's imagine for a minute that auto drive cars are good enough to where 90% of the automobile accidents that occur are, automobile accidents are decreased by 90%. Okay, who loses their jobs over that? Well, body shops. You need a lot fewer body shops if there's no automobile accidents, or much fewer.
Right.
All these automobile insurance companies. Yeah, you still have insurance companies. They get to charge much less because for their premiums because they don't pay out as much, and all those claims adjusters not needed. They can slash their workforce by a factor of 90% probably.
Right.
Emergency room doctors, you don't need those guys anymore. A fair proportion of the people that end up in the emergency room are there because of automobile accidents. Guys that do what I do for a living, they're not needed anymore either. So you're talking about a large, not just in one industry, but you're seeing a vast number of industries touched and potentially even wiped out completely by one simple thing: auto drive cars. And does anybody question that mankind will be better off? No. I mean, we all know that mankind will be better off once there are 90% fewer automobile accidents because the robot cars are that much better. It's a very much different world after that happens, and it's not just the convenience, which is going to be great, and the recaptured time, because you can be productive in other ways if your car is doing your driving for you. You can be doing mental work while you're on the commute. But beyond those things, whole industries will be very, very much different afterwards, and it's hard to even know how that world looks, and that's just one thing, the auto drive car, which is you mix that in with everything else we're talking
with
about.
With everything else, that's the point. I think the real sticking point to this, as I look at this and think about it, is just the lag time. It's the lag time between things being destroyed and people being pulled out of the system and people enjoying the benefits. And if you look at where we are right now, assuming that something actually systematic is occurring in the employment market, right now things don't look so great because people are losing jobs, but we're nowhere near being able to 3D print ourselves into a better world. I mean, we don't see widespread poverty, and we don't see social upheaval or any of those kinds of things. It's not anywhere near that dire, but that's worrying. It's worrying that potentially APM comes along and there's enough of it to wipe out employment as we know it, but not enough of it yet to get everybody where they need. You know what I mean? The lag time.
We got the radical, but we don't have the abundance. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. The lag time between the two. So what do we do about that? Now, I have some ideas about what we do about that. And when we had Martin Ford on the show, it was really interesting. He had some thoughts on what you do about that from an economic standpoint. And, those are interesting suggestions, and those can all be debated. But if you're an individual, I'm not going to talk about what society can do. We'll do that on another show. Maybe after we've finished reading Radical Abundance, we'll have our thoughts on that because I haven't gotten to that part of the book. We'll know what Drexler suggests, and he'll probably have some pretty good ideas. But what can individuals do generally with those four things going on? And here's what I think people need to do. These are my tips, and Stephen, you can add some. But if you're concerned about that future, I think the first thing you need to do is you need to be informed. You need to know what's happening. Don't let this come as a surprise to you. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that it's possible, I think everyone should become a 3D printer hobbyist.
yeah,
Which sounds like this really geeky, weird thing to take on. But there was a time not that long ago when saying everyone should get a computer and learn what that's all about would have sounded insane. But then everybody had one in their house, and it became this big driver of the economy. So to the extent that you can inform yourself about what's going on, and to the extent that you can start carving out a value proposition for yourself that maybe is independent as it possibly can be of any large organization that might disappear overnight, I think that's probably a smart idea. You need to be prepared to the extent that you can be prepared for potentially a period of uncertainty. And I'm not a big expert on that because I can tell you right now I'm not prepared for that. I'm not ready for the bottom to fall out and to go 18 months without a job or without food or something like that. And I know some people are. You know, some people are. You know, they're ready for if the power grid falls, right?
The preppers among us, yes.
Yeah, exactly, and you know, I'm starting to think that those people are onto something. I think that that we probably want to live lives that are significantly more resilient than they currently are. Not because I think terrible things are bound to happen, but because we can't rule them out. Because they might happen, and you know what? People are capable of doing a lot of things, and one of the things that we need to increase our capability in, one of the areas we need to bone up on in terms of capability is our ability to survive potentially difficult transitions. And the way we do that is by being ready for that transition and being as smart as we can possibly be, being as resilient as we can possibly be. That's my advice to the world on dealing with the catastrophic part until we get to the success part. What do you think?
My advice would be to get out there and research what the most innovative companies are, and to the extent that you can financially afford to do so, invest in them.
Yep.
That's a good idea too. Why is that? Because if you lose your job, but you are heavily invested, or at least somewhat invested in the innovative companies, then you own the very driver that's driving the people out of work, really, and you become one of the people that benefit from the changes rather than get. You know, you're, at least you have that much. You're an owner of the process that is putting people out of work. I know it sounds like a terrible thing, but actually, you know, once we've made it through the process, then we're, you know, the world, you know, hopefully it's going to be a much better place.
But, I like that tip. You know, if there are fewer and fewer buckets, and those buckets are bigger and bigger, get a little share of
the bucket.
At least
be an owner
of
the bucket. Be an owner of the big bucket. If you can't work for the big bucket, maybe you can do both. Go to work for one of these companies, and take the stock option at the same time would be probably my best tip for handling this. So
absolutely. Well, I think I'm going to add that one to the list. And generally, I think if you can. Provide value yourself, right? If you can become a value producer in your own right to some extent. And you know what? I'll tell you what, Stephen, I'm going to bookmark all these ideas because this is probably worth exploring in an entire show, just kind of your own future readiness. But I think those are all great ideas. Get smart. Be resilient. Own a piece of the action if you can. And, be ready to produce results in ways that you haven't in the past. And that's our best advice for getting to the creative side of the destruction, or to the success side of the catastrophic success. Okay, I know we're close on time. What's our music this evening?
The music this evening is Indoor Sunshine by the Power Goats.
Indoor Sunshine by the Power Goats. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Like I said, next week we're going to be doing some kind of grab bag surprise show. 2 weeks from tonight, we'll be talking about radical abundance. And 3 weeks tonight, we'll be welcoming guest Alexander Sabatelli to talk about life in the Matrix. So you're going to want to be here for all those programs. Look forward to being with you all then. And until next time, live to see it.
lost memory. My reason to forget perfect plans. You need to make it love me. Cold season I've ever known.